everybody. Thank you for coming back, because as I know, I think there are about only three experimentalists in the whole school. So there are more than three here, so that's nice. Furthermore, I think there's maybe some conspiracy theory here because of Cliff, the organizer of the school, because all my lectures are at 2:30 after lunch when everybody has this local minimum. Though I'm not quite sure what this means. Let's see.
I knew that you'd keep everyone awake, right?
So we were ending up with this huge, massive machine here to talk about the decay of beta decay, single beta decay of tritium, and the bound which we have currently achieved. And I told you, I showed you the slide, and we will see this neutrino mixing again and again, I showed you this XYZ system when you have eigenstates of mass and eigenstates of interactions, weak interactions. They can be identical, but they don't have to. So the electron mass is not a well-defined thing, because it depends on the matrix, three matrix elements which have a certain value which might change. So we know the electron neutrino by now has about 2 eV maximally. And this machine is supposed to measure it by a factor 10 better. So if everything goes well, this machine should come up with a neutrino mass detection, or the neutrino mass limit of about 0.2 eV or less. So this was the last picture I've showed. Then I had a bunch of discussion with students here, so I basically make my questions from the last lecture. This is page 1. Neutrino masses in the standard model. It's not a secret, as I told you in the 1950s, 1960s, 1950s, already we showed you on the old papers. It was known that the neutrino has a mass below a keV, and the electron is a second lightest particle which has 511 keV mass. So people were doing the standard model in a way that they basically left the neutrino massless. However, when you look in how particles get their masses in the standard model, you have this Yukawa couplings. So basically, you always have a left and right-handed object which you mount together, and then you get mass terms like E plus E, E bar E, or mu bar mu, or Q bar, which basically means you get a mass term. So, but you need for that, you need a left-handed and a right-handed object. So if you don't have these guys, this is basically the standard model version. You have these duplets which are mixing, the CKM matrix, using the 6 quarks and the 6 leptons we know. And you have also the singlet states with the right-handedness for all the quarks and the charged lepton. So if you remove this is all, and you basically, you can't make this mass term. However, if you add three more particles, like nu e right, nu mu rights as singlets, then you can make such terms as well, and you immediately get a neutrino mass. So this was, now actually the model is more symmetric even, because for each of those objects here, you find a partner for all of them. So, but this is officially not part of the standard model. And then we have these unknowns, this kind of couplings here, the C's for electrons and all other particles. And the big question is, we have to explain why this neutrino masses are so many orders of magnitude lighter than all the other ones. And in this case, when you mount them together, the right-handed states and the left-handed, you get the classical Dirac type of object. So this was one question. Then the second question, so this is the original paper by Fermi on the weak interaction. This is written in 2 languages, in Italian and in German. And here, this is a German version. And you see here, in 1934, short after the discovery of the neutron, he was already speculating that by the endpoint measurement, that's exactly what we discussed, yes, the 2 days before, that you get different values, you get different shapes of the endpoint energy when you have a non-vanishing neutrino rest mass. So this was already in the original paper by Fermi when he proposed the theory. Then the third question, we talked again of Fermi. As I told you, as I told you, basically it's also kind of an effective field theory. There was some chalk somewhere.
Yeah.
Which we also have seen that.
And if leave this here.
That Fermi was basically discussing this idea of particles, for example, let's make a neutron into a proton, and he makes some kind of a current, and you have an electron and a neutrino or antineutrino, and you make this kind of current. You have a coupling constant here, the Fermi constant, and then your Lagrangian function, the Fermi constant times this leptonic and hadronic current, how he called it. However, which operators are in these currents? How to do it? So this O is just a placeholder here. This was unknown, of course, and it took people some 20, 25 years to figure out what kind of operators could go in here. So for example, if it would be a scalar, it would be just the unitarity operator. If it's a vector, it's a gamma mu. A tensor would be something like this, and an axial vector and pseudoscalar are there, which you have gamma 5 and gamma mu gamma 5. And though the Wu experiment to show that parity is maximally violated and other measurements which people did on beta decay basically showed that in this kind of operators, the so-called V minus A in the V minus A interaction of a weak interaction, V minus A structure of weak interaction, meaning the operator, the actual operator is something like gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5, which you have to sneak in, though. This is A is gamma mu gamma 5 and V is gamma mu. So if you get the gamma mu out, you get terms like this, and this is basically everything which you need for classic and still valid low energy weak interactions. In modern time, we have, of course, now Feynman diagrams. We have a W boson exchange, and I told you the propagator here is Q square, the four momentum transfer minus MW square. And if Q square, which means is coming low, meaning low energy physics, here with double beta, and in beta decay, we are talking about MeV, KeV, not about TeV. Though the exchange, the potential four momentum transfer is much smaller than the W mass squared, which is about 80 GeV squared. So the whole thing basically becomes an effective field theory in a point-like structure here. And you can basically describe both ways. So this is still valid in low energy parts, what Fermi did already something like 80 years ago. This is a lepton structure, for example, or here. This would be the structure, the hadronic current, which I wrote here. This is a hadronic current, and this is a leptonic current. And if you do it, go from quark levels to real nucleons, neutrons, and protons, you get two more constants, the so-called axial vector constant and the vector constant, vector coupling and axial vector coupling. I come to that. So this is all intrinsically well defined. So this is the same picture here. And as I mentioned also, there of course has to be, because this is the same physics, just two different languages, there must be a relation between the Fermi function and the Fermi constant and the W mass, and this is basically the relation between Fermi constant and W mass. And there is another coupling from the weak electroweak interactions. Good. Then there were questions. There's more. There's all the nuclear correlations and beta decays, and I just, for those of you, because as you see, it's always done for the American Association of Physics Teachers, which somehow implies it's well understandable, hopefully. So Alessandro Garcia from UW made a very nice work here talking about helicity and correlations. So that you can download it. And I think it's really nice to read what kind of things you can study by having a polarized nucleus, and you make beta decay and you check the angular correlations and everything linked to it. Even nowadays, this can be, when you do it very precisely with spinning traps and other objects, you can always compete still with this LHC. when you look for example, for tensor contribution or scalar contribution in weak interaction, where we think about it's only axial and vector. So there are still searches also in the low energy frontier to get this done. This is question six. Question seven, somebody asked about the detector from Katrin. Whether the detector here, I told you the electrons come in here, and then the everything on the electron, we did it the other day. So basically because the field is inhomogeneous and the electrons follow the field line, the magnetic field goes down to here, the minimum. And then you have this kind, basically all electrons have the total spin directed towards this direction, that's what you want. By a conservation of angular momentum, as I showed. And then you have a threshold here and you say, okay, tritium might have something like 18,600 electron volt Q value. Though people make a potential here that they say everything which is not below 18,000 and let's make it 550 will be rejected backwards, and only the small part, which is actually having enough energy to bypass this threshold, can be going down here and will be accelerated again. So the energy here will be pretty much again the original energy from here. So it's just mirrored and you have this kind of threshold. So all the other electrons will be repelled backwards and you won't see them. And indeed the detector is inside. That's how it looks like. As I said, I cannot deduce it from the blackboard, which I would like to do, like the theorists do. I have to do this PowerPoint karaoke because I have to show 100,000 pictures and plots. Otherwise, I can't really do this. Sorry about that. So indeed, so these are these. So this is the very end of this big bottle. So the electrons come sneak in here. Here the detector, this which we were asked for. So this detector has pixels, 148 pixels. And it's basically depending from which part of the bottle, whether it's from the top here or in the middle or left and right, these electrons will be basically focused on 148 channels where you can actually get even a kind of a picture where the electrons are coming from this big plane, and you get also some spatial information from that. And this is silicon detectors. And just to see here again, this FPD, the focal plane detector, how it's called, this device here. This is inside ultra high vacuum, as we talked about. But on the other side, then there's a bit of electronics, and in this region, then also at the other side of the electronics, there is normal air. So inside there's a vacuum of 10 to the minus 12 bar. So this is a kind of experiment, and actually with those people who asked, there's a paper if you really want to know, a nuclear instruments and method paper, if you want to know how this detector works in this, only the end part of the detection, the rest of the thing is already done. So finally, the last one is, this didn't nobody ask, but I wanted to show you. I told you the neutrino is born by Pauli's letter on December 4, 1930. So if you have nothing else to do on December 4, you can always make a birthday party, which we do every year anyhow. So it's getting 88 years this year. Good, so this is the idea. This experiment is a go to 0.2. And as you have seen, the big bottle, which is 20 meter length and 10 meter diameter, if you have to go even further, this is not the way to go. You can't make it bigger, and people looking for alternatives. I only show here one slide because it's still in an R&D phase. So some clever guy in the past said, if you want to measure something accurate, measure frequencies, because frequencies you can really measure very well. So this is now the idea. People call it the cyclotron radiation emission spectroscopy. Basically, I told you about these Penning traps when atoms move around, ions move around in the magnetic field, and they have a cyclotron frequency. And this is pretty much the same here. The cyclotron frequency is linked to the kinetic energy, and this is basically the kinetic energy of the tritium ion which goes in. So people also aim not to make molecules. They also aim to get atoms because, as I told you, you have a lot of excitations in this region by atomic and molecular transitions. And basically, because the electron is then moving in the cyclotron motion and it's losing energy, and therefore you get this kind of, you can see the energy, the frequency change. You see when the energy here changes, this one changes too. So you can basically imagine here, you see the body of electrons going around in this trap and losing energy, and therefore the frequency changes. And in this way, you can somehow determine the kinetic energy of the hope. So this is the idea. They maybe can go below 0.1 electron volt. So what I told you here, as I said again, was the mass of the electron antineutrino, if we are very, very picky. The alternative to measure the mass of the neutrino would be electron capture. So the point is, as you might know, some people check always CPT theorem, whether CPT is conserved. For people, for example, measure the mass of the proton and the antiproton and other things. And people might want to also check out whether the neutrino, maybe the neutrino mass and the antineutrino mass are identical. And this idea is a bit older already, but just the idea the following. You have a nucleus, which basically has the option to capture an electron from the shells. I told you, or you know it from school, that S orbitals have always a non-vanishing probability to be at the origin, and therefore in the nucleus, and then the nucleus captures one electron, emits an electron neutrino, and then the nucleus is, or the shell has empty, has a hole, and this will be refilled by emission of X-rays or internal Brennstrahlung or whatever. So you can use this de-excitation spectrum or this internal Brennstrahlung to try to measure the neutrino mass. This is a complex equation which I don't want to discuss at all, but you see there's an mu square here. And this is what people try to do. It's an old idea. People have thought about it long enough. There's an isotope called holmium-163. If you capture that, if you take that, you get an electron, you get dysprosium in an excited state, you emit your neutrino, this dysprosium de-excites and you get basically a spectrum here. And the Q value is very small. It's only 2 to 3 kV or 2.8 kV, it's written down here. So basically mean you cannot make an K-shell capture, you cannot make an L-shell capture. You have only M and N and O-shell captures. So this is basically, you capture from the shells, from the atomic shells further outside. And then you see this kind of funny spectrum here. And if you look very careful here, the endpoint here, it's a little bit similar like the speeder decay. The endpoint here will basically change when you have a neutrino mass. As you can see, people have done experiments in 1987, and they came up with a bound of 225 eV. So compare this to this, it's a factor of 100. So that's why people were not doing this for a very, very long time. But things, and especially technology, has improved because, as I said here, you have to look at this part. And if you blow it up, amplify, you will see this will be the path for the neutrino no mass. This will be the path for 2 eV, for example. And of course, as before I said, we have again using a Penning trap to measure the masses so accurate that we can actually go down on atomic masses of 163 GeV by a precision of less than an electron volt. That's what I also said to the tritium. You have an atom which has basically 161 protons and neutrons, so 160 GeV object, and you have to know the mass differences from mother to daughter by the level of 1 electron volt. How they do it? It's a technology which is pretty much like in dark matter, very often used. It's so-called cryobolometers. So if you go to temperatures below 1 Kelvin, the specific heat of the lattice of a metal goes with a Debye law according T to the power of 3. So basically, when you cool down some object or some not a conductor but normal insulator, you cool it down to below 1 keV, one Kelvin, sorry. And if there is now an energy deposition in your detector, there will be a temperature jump. If this is a total, this is a total heat capacity that the energy you dump in, and this is the temperature jump. And this temperature jump is pretty much your information. Though the more energy deposition, the higher the temperature jump is going. And then from that, you can basically do the temperature as a spectroscopic object. So this is basically super CDMS and CREST and other dark matter experiments. They all use the same idea here to cool down to 100 millikelvin or 10 millikelvin. And when you have an energy deposition, there will be just so much lattice excitation so that you get this rise. And you can measure this temperature basically by this temperature from this, the energy from the temperature jump. So that's also the idea here.
Sorry?
Yeah.
What should be G? The inverse of a resistance.
This G here?
Yeah.
That's actually a good question.
Should it be a resistance or something?
I think it's it seems to be probably something with the coupling and the pulse rise time or the pulse shape, I would imagine, yeah, how to do it. This was just a cartoon to show how a cryobolometer somehow works. So basically energy deposition makes the temperature jump and then the pulses go down with some time. So these are the two experiments, Holmes and Echo. So the references are given there. And this is really fantastic what these people can do, maybe at least for an experimentalist. You really, these guys are able to make these lines, which we saw before, this M and N lines, but also the energy resolution, meaning the sharpness of the peak. So this is basically 5,900 electron volts, and this is 5,880 electron volts. And you can clearly identify the two lines from each other, though the resolution, so the width of the peak is only 1.5 electron volt for 6,000 or kind of 6,000 electron volts, which is fantastic. It's really good. And the hope is that with this measurement, you maybe get the 225 electron volt this year. You maybe get a new number, which is in the ballpark of 10 electron volt. So there is a fair chance that you will get a paper this year where this will, the 225 will be basically 10 or even less. So this is ongoing experiments, and they have potential, depending now on how good they are, to go to this part here. Okay, then something which I want to talk too much about, but it's old beta decay. As I told you 2 days ago when we talked about a loud transition, there is a simple way when the spin changes only by 0 or 1. The parity does not change. You can make a linearized version of the spectrum, which is called a Curie plot. So you got a straight line. And what is a cartoon showing here? Cartoon showing here, if you now have, for example, 3 mass eigenstates for neutrinos, and if they would be really far away from each other, you would basically see though this one is M1, for example, where the neutrino masses, only the fraction is very small, and if you have other components, they would go deeper down. And then you would get actually distortions here. So this one would, for example, die out here, and the next one would die out here. And in this way, people were always looking for kinks in the spectra, and this is still a way to check out whether some other neutrino states are mixing into the classical with the electrons, or that you have a UE something. So the electron mixing for sterile neutrinos or just other things. So this is still ongoing. It has quite some history. Some decades ago, we were plagued with that because experiments showed something like this, which gave us a hint that there would be 17 keV neutrino, so which means, so the here's the real endpoint, And there's one state which is 17 stopping 17 keV below this endpoint, though there would be a kind of a change in this linearized version because this state will stop here with 17 keV, which is quite a distance from the endpoint. And there were, I would say 30 measurements all over the world. 15 say there is a kink, and 50% say there is no kink. And at the end of the day, it was ruled out. So this, we are talking here about 1990, but still, as you can see, in 2011, the 17 keV neutrino can still be around. So things you never kill, you never can kill things, really. So people will always dig it out again. So this kind of thing you can also use, and people use to measure for something new. Good. So this is beta decay. You maybe find it already complex. Now we make it double beta decay. It's double, twice as complex. So this is, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Can you do an electron capture sort of experiment where you're not actually just waiting for the atoms to decay, but you're actually like shooting an electron beam at the, you know, at the nuclei?
People haven't done this way so far. Yeah, no. They were typically, what they do, they activate. This holmium has a long half-life. It's a radioactive isotope of about 4,000 years. So you produce them, you make an activation, then you have a big pool of, I don't know, megabecquerel or more, and then you just wait for the decays. So typically, the people, this is much easier. You just go to CERN, you dump something in a reactor or wherever you make your activation, and then you have your radioactive source. Building an electron beam is probably more expensive and takes more time, and whatever the accelerator will do for you. Okay, now double beta decay. As a word that, as I said, it's a very interesting process. So the idea here is you have an atomic nucleus which is characterized, so basically, which means a beta decay, just to remind you, is a neutron goes to a proton, electron, and antineutrino. And as the word double beta decay implies, two neutrons simultaneously decay in two protons, two electrons, and two antineutrinos. Okay, that's all fine. But the probability that in one atomic nucleus, two neutrons simultaneously decay is not so high. So we are talking here for this radioactivity or half-life. You maybe know something like dating from ancient humans, carbon 14, 5,000 years. Half-life, it's already long. We talked about this, what I said 2 days ago, that we call stable isotopes when the half-life is longer than the age of the universe, which is about 10 to the 10 years. Here I'm talking about 10 to the 20 years. So this is 10 to the 10 times the age of the universe. So this is a mode which is okay, which is nothing special on it. But the second mode, that's the interesting one. You can have the case that the nucleus decays into its daughter, emitting two electrons and no neutrino at all. And this is a so-called neutrinoless double beta decay. And this, from your knowledge in nuclear and particle, in particle physics especially, maybe you know this is lepton number violation. You see here have no leptons, here you have nuclear baryons, and here have two electrons. So this process is violating lepton number. This is fundamentally important and would be a big step out of the standard model, because we have never seen. We have, then Art MacDonald got the Nobel Prize for the flavor changes between muons, taus, and electrons, but here, this is flavor violation, but this is total lepton number. And this is a big step. This is a big step. So how can we do that? It's not an endpoint measurement like for the single beta decay. It's a different way. So this is the first process. Just two neutrons randomly, for example, decay to each decay. But the second mode is interesting because you have a neutron here going into a proton, which I don't paint here. The electron goes away and you emit a right-handed antineutrino. But you can only absorb this right-handed antineutrino on a neutron again if you have a left-handed neutrino. Otherwise, you cannot get a right-handed antineutrino on a neutron. This, I remember when we talked about the detection from the discovery of neutrinos, it was from reactors. There were new E-bars. hitting a proton, making a neutron and a positron. So when you turn things around, you cannot do this. You cannot capture a new E bar on a neutron. You can only capture it on a proton. So basically what happens here, the neutron emits this right-handed antineutrino in a simple picture, and which has to be absorbed as a left-handed neutrino here. So the first thing means that the neutrino is its own antiparticle. So this is basically the Majorana character, which was predicted by some decades ago. So you have the fact that neutrino and antineutrino are identical, and this makes your lepton number violation. And the second point here is the helicity. If you have a purely right-handed neutrino state, it has a certain helicity, but you need the opposite helicity on this point. So you cannot do this with massless object because the helicity is plus minus one. So you need a mass, because when you have the emission here of a right-handed of the antineutrino, it's a mixture. The wrong helicity is mixed in by a term M over E. And this term, this fraction M over E, or the M, can be absorbed at this neutron to make an electron. So which it means, if the wrong helicity, which is part of this game here, of this first part here, is getting larger and larger, the probability to be captured here is also getting larger and larger, which means that the process is becoming more likely. And in this way, we measure the half-life. It's like a seesaw kind of thing, though the lighter the neutrino might be, meaning the helicity, the original helicity is getting closer to one, the more unlikely you absorb it here, and this means the more unlikely will be the production, the process, and therefore the half-life will go up. So this is not like in beta decay where we look at the endpoint. Here we go to a case where we basically, the longer we measure this decay or we look for this decay and we don't see it, we know that the neutrino mass has to be smaller and smaller. So it's half-life versus mass, so to say. And this is basically talking now all about well beyond 10 to the 20 year half-life measurements. So this is, I think, a lepton number violation, total lepton number violation. That would be a big, big deal. So as I told you, Fermi said it in 1935. Maria Goeppert-Mayer already at that time had an idea to do double beta disintegration. So it's not so long ago. And she was discussing this process which is allowed. Two neutrons go, two protons, two electrons, and two neutrinos. And in December 39, Wendell Ferry came up with a paper, and he actually discussing the neutrinoless version of this. And other people like Racah and Majorana, they also made a bunch of papers on that topic. So, okay. So what can we do? We have enough isotopes. In total, I think we know about more than 3,000 isotopes. Let's go. However, there are some boundary conditions from nuclear physics. And the point here, this is again my chart of nuclides. We have proton number versus neutron number. So this, as I told you, these are the stable ones, and the other, the colored ones, are radioactive. First of all, when you have a nucleus here, which is doing beta decay, which is a normal way to do it, I show you in a second a plot which makes it maybe easier to understand. You have to forbid single beta decay, because when single beta decay is much shorter, so if your next neighbor isotope, you know, you have a certain energy level. We show it. I show it again in a second on the slide. So here's your state, and classically, which I showed 2 days ago, you have a beta decay going down here. So then you basically you change your atomic number by one. And then basically you make another, you can, if this is unstable, you can go to this one here too, Z plus two. So you have just a chain of two subsequent beta decays. But this is not what you want for double beta decay. You need a scenario, badly done. You have your A set, The A1, this one here, has to be higher to block it. However, the second next, so make it this one. This is beta decay, and this is double beta decay. And the second next one, like this guy, has to be lower again. So this one has to block single beta decay. Otherwise, you would never ever see this. It would be just a sequence of decays. Is this understandable? So you have to block it. Is that the energy conservation? You cannot just go there. You would violate energy conservation. So this is meant with here. First of all, this one has to be higher than this one. And the second requirement is that this one has to be higher than this one. And there's a small loophole. When you have very, very highly forbidden beta decays, you can also do it, because then double beta decay is actually longer, shorter half-life than beta decay. So this is what I said. So we have this original atom nucleus, which has to be larger than its daughter. And then the single beta decay must be forbidden somehow, or at least very strongly suppressed by momentum changes. So what I just tried to paint here is now shown here. This is a so-called isobars. These are all isotopes, not all, but most of them, with an atomic mass of 76. So now you see here, nickel 76 is basically an energy scale. So you see this guy up there, it makes beta decay to here, it makes beta decay to here, makes beta decay to here, makes beta decay to here. And now it would like to go from here to here, but it's forbidden by energy conservation, because the ground state of this nucleus is higher than here. Right, so it's blocked. This is exactly this scenario here. And then this guy, of course, then basically the wave from going from here to here, now you can describe it as you tunnel through, or you find a wave jumping over it, but at least this one is blocked. So it's a second order process. You somehow have to manage to go from here to here by bypassing this wall. And then if you do that, from all the 3,000 isotopes we know, we are ending up with 35, because normally this is really just a parabola. It all goes down and it goes up again. And only in rare 35 cases, you get the case that somebody is blocking in the last step. So the number of isotopes we can use is not thousands, it's 35. And the same actually can happen on the other side. It's mirror imaged. Basically, you can also have something which we could call double positron decay or double electron capture. It's just the same process. Two neutrons going in two protons and two electrons. And of course, you can now also jump it around, and you can make a, you can convert, because you're in a nucleus, you have binding energy. You can also make it in the opposite direction, two protons going in two neutrons and two positrons, P plus, or you make electron capture here. Plus 2P goes to two neutrons. And depending now whether you are doing now neutrinoless or with neutrinos, you have to write the neutrinos here. So this can also happen on the other side. And again, if you actually, I don't know whether it's physics or a coincidence, if you look through all the tables, you find 35 also on the right side. So you can do 35 beta minus, or you can find 35 double electron captures, or beta decay, beta plus. So that's the kind of thing. So from all the isotopes we have, we can only select, and almost all action is going on this mode, with the two electrons, which I have shown here. Okay, so you get a nucleus going into another nucleus by emitting two electrons. So what kind of signal you might have? So we can, of course, look for the two electrons coming out of nowhere from a nucleus. There might be information that the electrons have an angular correlation when you have two electrons. The beauty is, and the neutrinoless decay, I'm talking now about the neutrinoless decay, is the sum energy for the neutrinoless has to be the Q value, the energy difference in this from here to here. from here to here, this energy difference has to be, will be a peak. Peaks are always nice for experimentalists. If you have distribution, it's not so nice. If you have a sharp peak, it's nice. You maybe can look for the daughter ion if you have your corresponding experiment and maybe gamma rays. When you go, for example, for the double positron decay, you should see 4 5 11 keV photons which are going basically by 180 degrees. So you have a bunch of things where you can dream about to think how to measure that. This is very busy. I don't want you to understand it too much. So first of all, this is a two neutrino decay, the first line. This is standard, as I said. It's zero plus transitions. And again, it's basically Fermi's golden rule. You have some prefactors, a decay rate, so to say, and then a matrix element squared. So the initial wave function, then your weak interaction operator, intermediate state, another intermediate state, a system here, another beater, another term here, and the final. And then you take the absolute squared, and you can calculate things. And this is basically shown here. This is a plot for the two neutrino double beta decay neutrinoless mode for a specific isotope, which has an endpoint at about 2000 keV. And you see here, this would be the electron shape. If you have two neutrinos, because the two antineutrinos will take energy away. Like I told you 2 days ago with the cake, when we talked about the cake and eating a cake fast or slow. It's the same game here. However, if you have no neutrinos, so if it's neutrinoless double beta decay, of course, both electrons take away the mass difference or the energy difference between mother and daughter isotope, and therefore you get a straight line. So this is very nice for experimental point of view. And these other ones, these are more exotic decay modes when you have a Majorone involved. So for example, that's how I learned about the organizer of this cool. He, in 1992, had this crazy idea to make Majorone double beta decay. And then with our collaboration started somehow a long time ago. So but you see, this is, there's angular correlations between the electrons you might can use. But the fundamental thing is we have two processes, two neutrino and two electrons, no problem. It's just unlikely. Nothing very new and exciting from particle physics point of view. And we have the neutrinoless mode. Very nice signature. We know precisely where to look. And that's good. However, it's a general process. So any process you can imagine, if you're a clever person, which you are all here, you can think about which is violating lepton number. There's more physics. Basically, you convert two d quarks in a neutron in two u quarks of a proton, and you get your two electrons. And here's a tiny list of all things you can imagine how you can do that. In principle, it's a black box thing, right? You can use what I described, the light Majorana neutrinos. This is basically what I will talk about. There might be very heavy Majorana neutrinos. There might be something like double charged Higgs bosons, which fly around, they can do that. There are supersymmetry options. You can find, maybe one day people find right-handed weak interactions. What we had before was all left-handed. And you come up with your personal ideas. Here, your PI, you can probably invent a particle every day if you want. So then again, you have to the rate or the inverse half-life. Again, the phase space can be calculated. This one we have to discuss. This is again the matrix element, like in Fermi's golden rule, or which I showed before. And this is a quantity which depends on which of those you are actually choosing for your interest. So this is a quantity you want to know. And it's actually nice, the LHC and double beta decay at the current status, how the numbers are, they are basically helping each other in a way that the measurements by double beta decay you can already confine and confine or restrict LHC measurements and vice versa. So that's for the next years, this will be more and more entertaining, and maybe we can rule out some of those options from LHC to be part of double beta decay. Because at the end of the day, we might don't know what's going on. So if I stay with my this version here and I remove this black part, then the Feynman diagram would be pretty much like this. Somewhere here are the neutrons or the NP. You have your mass term for the neutrino mass. And here you have again these mixing elements, UEI, which we have seen before. So, however, there is a big difference here. You see the mass here is not the incoherent part. So for double beta decay, that's my chalk. Lost my chalk. Number. So for double beta decay, this is actually the summation over all states squared and then the absolute value. But there is even more to it, which I show you on this slide here in a second. Just to remind you, which is nowadays pretty much out of fashion because the oscillation which we talk about, the mass measurements, is if you would look for the mass of the muon neutrino in a classic way, how it has been done for a long time, you basically go to an accelerator, you make pions, a pi plus or a pi minus, you bring the pi minus at rest, and then let the pi minus decay into a muon and muon neutrino. So if you would go in this ancient part, so pion decay at rest, then the limit here would be about 190 keV for the muon neutrino. And if you also would be interested in the measurements for the mu tau in the classical way, then you have a tau decay. The tau particle goes into a new tau and a bunch of pions, five pions or something like this. And then in this way, you will get a neutrino mass limit of about 18.2 MeV. So these are basically the measurements from the accelerators or from which we could do. But now from the oscillation, which we show behind after that, you will see that these values are pretty much outfashioned a little bit from the oscillation point of view. So this is the equation. This are again the cosine and the sine is defined. So cosine theta 1,2, cosine theta 1,3. The other one doesn't show up. But the important part here is by Schechter and Walle all a long time ago. But the statement which holds is if you observe this process, then you know that neutrinos are Majorana particles. This is a crucial statement. People actually calculated this Feynman diagram of higher order, and they came up with a very small mass of 10 to the minus 23 eV or so. So this mass has nothing to do with the oscillations, but this statement is still valid. That if you see this peak, you know that neutrinos are Majorana, and then you know that.
So you observe like neutrino less than beta k, can you also like measure the mass of the neutrino, or it's not possible?
So this when you see it, you can basically measure this one here. When you ever see it, you get a half life. So let me maybe give me two more slides, and then if you're not clear, then maybe you come back, we can come back. So this is now the phase. So this is now the same equation like before, but I have to make a statement here. The point is, if you ignore this one, so this sheet here is what we have seen 2 days ago. This is this PMNS matrix when we had this kind of system. Where we said we have some eigenstates nu e, which are the mass eigenstates, and they are somehow connected with the flavor eigenstates. How do I call them? Nu e or whatever, something like this. Nu alpha, for example. And then we have this mixing matrix in between, which is associating the 3x3 mixing matrix, which is on the blackboard. How to convert them to each other. This is basically this part here. And then in particle physics, you have a lot of complex phases. But most of them you can basically absorb or get rid of by redefining the fields. So the, if you have common global complex phases, they can go all the way. But by the end of the day, when you go through the standard model for the CKM matrix and also for the neutrinos, you're ending up with three angles, which you have to know somehow, which we will do after the mass measurements. And then we have this complex phase here. So this is for the quarks, and this is also true for neutrinos if they are not Majorana. However, if they are Majorana neutrino, and that's unfortunate for this for the measurement, is basically it, you require that the charged neutrino and the charge conjugate neutrino state is identical to the original one. You know, because I told you neutrino and antineutrino, there is only these two states now. Neutrino and antineutrino are the two-state object, not a four-state object. And if you do all the mathematics, you end up two more. You get two more phases. Now we have three. This is a normal one, basically, and this one only appears when you have the state that the neutrino is its own antiparticle. And the ugly part is this doesn't show up, as far as I know, maybe Cliff can correct me, in any other process. So we will not get any information on these two phases by any other process. But this maybe can be discussed at one point. And then again, it's like this total, the absolute value of the summation of all these terms, cosine theta 1 2 square, cosine theta 1 3 square times the mass state 1, sine square, cosine again, and then you have for the first time one of those, and then you have the other one. The other two, this one here. So we, and then you get the total value, right? It's not like, it's not like here, that's the incoherent or coherent sum. Here you have the total squared, basically. So basically everything is inside here instead of making the square was okay here. So basically this is a different story here. So the absolute values are here. You take each value and sum it up. Here you sum it up first, and then you take the total. So this is also different. So beta decay and double beta decay actually measure different things. And also beta decay does not care about alpha 1, alpha 2, and the delta, while double beta decay does. So these things are not competitive. They are actually helping each other. This always goes up.
So, sorry.
Yeah.
The only way then to measure in case the two alphas and the delta would be to know precisely the mass, not only of the tree flavor, but also of the M1, M2, and M3, right?
Yeah, it will be tough. Because people were fiddling around a little bit how many measurements you have to do in which direction to get a little bit of information on these alphas and. But it's not clear. It's not clear yet how to disentangle them. So the other thing, maybe to your question, even then the real work anyhow will start when the peak is observed. Assume you see all of a sudden the peak you want to see, and everybody's very, very happy, of course. But then the real work will start, because from this shopping list I showed you here, you don't know how many they contribute unless LHC rules out most of this stuff. But otherwise, you maybe have maybe right-handed currents for 50% of the peak and 50% neutrino mass, or maybe you have air parity violation things and neutrino mass and right-handed currents, or any kind of wild mixtures and combinations. So as beautiful as it is that we will know it one day, to extract the neutrino mass, it's pretty much essential to somehow constrain or maybe kill all the other processes which are here on the board. So that will be another one. Good. So from the experimental point of view, as I said, it's very nice. You get a peak, and you know the peak because you know the mass of the mother isotope, and the daughter isotope mass, so you know where your peak is supposed to be. And as I said, the half-life will be given by the phase space. You can probably calculate matrix element, I will comment on, And then the mass is neutrino mass, which was just written here on the other slide. So what parameters, if you ever think about making such an experiment, what kind of experimental issues might be interesting for you? How can you make it better? So there are a bunch of parameters which come in when you want to search for it. Of course, you would like to have as many isotopes as possible of your interest, because this gives you a strong source strength. So typically, people manipulate their the isotopes by isotopical enrichment. For example, we do it in a one isotope, which I had before in this parabola, germanium-76. If you go to the shop and say, I want to have 100 grams of germanium, then it's only 8% of them is germanium-76. But I would love to have 100%, so I have to go to Russia. And the Russian people still have their atomic weapon stuff, or the former ones, and they make long centrifuges, and then you get 88% or 90% abundance, but it's very expensive. Then what always goes in, though, this is the abundance term. Then you have a so-called efficiency, meaning this decay is really rare, and you better make sure that you see any of them. If it happens, you want to see it, not one out of 100 you will see. Right? If you have a lot of decays, you maybe say, okay, if I only measure every second or third or tenth one, that's all fine. In double beta, this is not the case. You try to make sure if there is a decay, you see it. So this is called efficiency. Then we have two more parameters, and these are all the games. So this is basically the mass you have. This is the abundance, enrichment, the efficiency to see it 100% if you can. And then we have two, the measuring time, so whether I measure 2 minutes or 5 years or 10 years, of course. And then you have the so-called background. This is a major game, that's why the talk is called rare event searches. Because in a real life spectrum, it looks like here. So you know your peak here, 2 MeV. Now you look at this energy and you see all these kind of funny things. So it's not completely empty. It's not completely empty. So there are some events, and you basically can average that, and this level is called background. Ideally you would make it to zero, and then you maybe got a peak. So the peak, as I said, what we call resolution before, the peak can be like a spike, like CN Tower in Toronto, but it can also be like a hill. It goes like this, depending on which detector you use. Right? So not every detector has such a resolution. There are detectors where it go more like this. And these are the crucial parameters you can sneak around or fit around, and that's why so many people have different ideas how to do, because they have different opinions which of those numbers, efficiency, energy resolution, mass, or whatever, is more important than the other one. Okay, so if you have no background, in the ideal case, there is nothing like this stuff here. Then actually your half-life measurement goes linear with your measuring time, though. The longer you measure, the more you gain. However, when you have background, when you have these events, then if you go, you can make a rough estimation. If you're interested, I can paint it for you. But then everything goes only with the square root of the measuring time. So which means at one point it flattens off, and it makes not sense to make a longer measurement anymore. So why do I do this exercise? So these are the things which people play around, because this is a big factory or machinery in particle physics to get this stuff done. And I should mention from this equation here, if you merge it with this ones here, the neutrino mass then is proportional. You can the sensitivity on the mass you get, because here is a square 2, the fourth root of all these parameters. So the energy resolution, as sharp as possible, the background, ideally zero, mass as much as you can, and time as long as you can measure before you die. So these are the parameters. And sometimes people say, we have now 100 millielectron volts. Well, let's make a factor 2. Sounds easy, but for an experimentalist means you have to improve this by a factor 16. So it's not so easy for an experimentalist, because we are already working on the edge of what is feasible.
So, yeah. What What exactly do you mean here with background free or limited? You mean that the double beta decay with neutrino and not without the neutrino is like very well separated, or?
For example, yeah.
Okay.
For example, but now that this means basically this would mean you can do that by energy. This is more energy resolution. Basically, what I mean, some detectors are so sharp that maybe this one or the tailing to here is maybe very small. Mm-hmm. So what you want basically that this plot is empty.
Yeah. I was just wondering. I mean, from the design of your experiment, you are like choosing in an active way, let's say, if you want to be background limited or background free.
Of course, you would like to be background free.
Okay.
But there are some. This is. I show you the experiments or the list. Everybody has his personal opinion. So
okay.
Some people, for example, in this experiment, which I will mention a little bit, at the moment we are background free. The only experiment in the world where we have waiting for the peak here, there's nothing. I show you a spectrum in a bunch of minutes. So there's here something, and here something, here's your peak, there's nothing. In Snow Plus, which we do in Canada here, for they have instead of 100 or 200 grams, they have 2.3 tons. But they have a very bad energy resolution. So what they see, there is a wall coming down. All this here is full of events, and then you have to check out here to make convinced people that this is a peak hanging out here. So basically, immediately you lose half of your signal because this is really like a steep wall going up. And then you have to look whether here is something which you can make a half peak or so. So everybody has its own opinion on how to do that. Maybe I show you a bunch of slides, and if you still don't understand, then we can debate it for the rest of the week. So that's what I said, rare event search. That's a needle in a haystack search, but the picture is wrong. The needle is much too large and the haystack is much too small. This is like a real needle would be finding a needle on the Earth. This is like solar neutrinos. It's the same what Ray Davis did. So basically, it's really like you have to find a small needle somewhere on this planet. This is double beta decay.
There's a needle in a haystack. Like looking for a needle in a haystack where the needle decays to hay after some time.
If you're lucky, yeah. So this would be the perfect world experiment. No background, nothing disturbing you. Your peak is sharp, it's a delta function. You have 100% isotopical abundance, 100% detection infinity, infinite amount of measuring time, infinite amount of mass means infinite amount of money. And then you can then you can do the perfect world experiment, right? However, real life, it doesn't go like this. But this would be the ideal experiment. So just to give you a feeling, so this is now again a simple, hopefully simple example. Assume you want to measure 50 millielectron volts, because we know already double beta decay is also in the same ballpark like beta decay. So we are talking about EV and less. So assume you can add some more zeros if you want, but take the radioactive decay law, independent of any experiment. Think about the radioactive decay law. So you have no background, just the formula you know from school. So in the limit that the half-life is much longer than the measuring time, which is a fair statement, I think with 10 to the 25 years, we will not measure that long. For this, you can write the radioactive decay law in this version, the half-life and the numbers here. Now, it turns out when we want to go for 50 millielectron volts, we have to measure half-lives in the ballpark of 10 to the 26 to 10 to the 27 years, which is quite long. So just for personal amusement, right? Sometimes even I want to see something. Just for personal amusement, I want to have one decay per year. I'm not asking for much, right? One event per year. So you need something like 10 to the 26 to 10 to the 27 source atoms. Now you know Avogadro's constant. Avogadro constant is 6 times 10 to the 23. So make it 6 times 10 to the 26. You have 1,000 moles. Now take an isotope of molybdenum 100. 1 mole of molybdenum is 100. And if you have 1,000 moles, you have 100 kilograms. Right? So if I take 100 kilograms of molybdenum 100, which actually is a double beta nuclide, you dump it in and you want to have one decay per year. then you are entering this region of 10 to the 26 years, and then you can tackle 50 millielectron neutrino masses. If you don't can, if you can't do that, you tackle only 100 millielectron volt or more. So this is the worst, best case scenario. I haven't used any experiment here. I just made the radioactive decay law and some half-life number. And from that point on, you only lose. You never have 100%. You have a background and so on and so on. So it's really a tricky game. Good, from all these, it turns out this is a list we people look at, because from the 35 I mentioned, the phase space also plays a role. So basically the phase space, meaning the number of final states, goes with the Q value, or basically the point of the peak with the fifth power. So from the 35 events I mentioned to you before, or the elements which can, nucleates which can do it, when you request yourself, okay, the Q value, the higher the Q value, the more phase space I have. And though people only look at lines at this spike line above 2 MeV, the list from 35 collapses to 11. And these are the 11 ones. That's that the headliners are this. Maybe I show it to you. These are the 11 isotopes which people consider. So this is calcium 48, germanium 76, selenium 82, zirconium 96, molybdenum 100, where I just made my example from. Palladium 110, cadmium 116, tin 24, tellurium 130, and xenon 136, and 150 neodymium. So you see, these are the elements, the isotopes. If you go home and think about it, you want to make a double beta experiment, you should choose one of those 11. You see, although that these are experimental names, it's not a, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, there are more, much more than 10 experiments, and still a lot of R&D experiments. And although there is no super isotope, because everybody would go to the super isotope, because it's the super isotope, right? So we see, for example, you say, oh, the Q value, it goes with fifth power. Let's go for calcium, because it's by far the highest number here, right? 4.2 MeV. Well, nobody has this. But the abundance is only 0.2%, in contrast to here, where the people have 30%. Right, so nature is really not nice to us in a certain way, that you get high Q values, you get very low abundance, and calcium enrichment is a nightmare. So palladium is very expensive, so there is nobody looking on this one. And then basically pick up whatever you want, and it doesn't make sense. You can just pick one without any offending my friends and colleagues, but you see some experiment names, and it's the same. As I said, some people, Snow Plus aims for Mars because tellurium has a high abundance, like Cuore 2. Gerda, which I will talk a little bit about, aims for energy resolution and enrichment. And so Kendall's goes for the high Q value. And so everybody has its own opinion. Anyhow, it's maybe very nice that maybe a 2 or 3, if we really see it one day, you would like a confirmation by another isotope. So this is far future dream. Let's see.
The colors and the names, blue and gray.
The blue ones are the blue ones mean they have made some physical publications on results or half-life limits. The other ones have not published any half-life. So how do you do this when you want to see this needle in a haystack? So the first thing is you need an underground laboratory. So that looks a little bit more modern today, but it's pretty much it. You go in a mine, you go deep underground as much as you can to get rid of all the cosmic ray particles which are flying around here. So this is underground stuff. That's why people call me working in Canada since 20 years, because in Sudbury there's a 2 kilometer deep mine, and other people hanging out in mountains or wherever. Then the really nasty one are the natural decay chains. This comes actually from the origin of the universe. Their elements production, Ravel spoke about that, but there is uranium, thorium, and they have half-lives which are in the ballpark of the age of the universe, 10 to the 10 years. And these uranium lines, uranium-238, 245, and thorium-228, they are long-living, and there they go all the way down. You see this alpha decays, beta decays, gammas coming in. They all go down as a function of time, down to lead, to the lead isotope, which is stable. But all these guys hanging out here, they are hanging in your body, they're hanging in the wall, they are everywhere. And then you can also add radon, which you can sneak in, and then you still have this part of the, have part of these kind of things. And they are really, really in your body. I mean, you have a 5,000 becquerel radioactivity in your body just because of these guys here. There is also cult potassium 40 and other stuff. So this is, of course, completely disturbing such an experiment. So you have to work as clean as possible. So I give you another example from Italy, Gran Sasso, was from about 1995. So again, underground, instead of a mine, you go into a mountain by a tunnel. So you try and bend, you have guaranteed, your experiment is somewhere in here, you have a guaranteed 1.5 kilometer of rock in all directions to shield against cosmic rays. Then you take one of these detector types, which is germanium, assume I'm talking about this element from out of these 11. So you make a germanium semiconductor detector. So the idea is the detector is equal to the source, right? You make a germanium detector, which of course contains germanium 76, and the germanium 76 should decay, but with a half-life of 10 to the 26 years or so. So the detector is decaying. It's like a Coke can or your mug, the size maybe a bit larger. You encapsulate it, and then you make it as clean as possible to avoid all these isotopes which I just showed on the previous slide. For example, so these detectors are semiconductors, and they are well known in nuclear physics. They are very, have a very fantastic energy resolution, so you get clear and sharp peaks. For example, you see here some construction work. So people have something here on their head, and they have their mouses, and they have gloves. Because if you would do this kind of mounting here and you lose one of your hairs, maybe I lost one, but my anyhow gone. This is a radioactive calibration source. And you close this thing down, you will see this hair like, or whatever, you spit on it. That's why you have something in your mouth. But if you're sweating and do this like, and you close on this detectors before you make your shielding, you can forget your experiment. So this
safety reason, you have to take the gloves and everything to.
Yeah, but at that time, Gran Sasso was more relaxed. You could do a lot of funny things, but yeah. it was more not to bring in any kind of contaminations. And if you banana, for example, a banana, you should, people think people are very concerned about one becquerel. Take a banana. If you put it on this detector, this will be like a calibration source. Anyhow, so this is such a spectrum. You see all this usual suspect I mentioned. The scary one is this one, because this is the highest gamma line. So when the gamma makes Compton scattering in the detector, it makes tails. And you see here the peak where we would like to see nothing.
But you see something.
And these are all this potassium 40, which I mentioned, which is also primordial, like from the beginning of the universe. And all the other ones come from this decay chain I mentioned. You see here cobalt here. This is coming from the copper from the previous site. So you see the copper here. This is copper here. But of course, you have to transport the copper from A to B. And while doing that, you're on surface. So cosmic rays hammer on your copper and you get cobalt radioactive isotopes of 3 years. So people in America actually started to make copper growing underground so that the copper never ever sees the surface. So then we make a lot of funny things to get this down. So then you might think, oh, these guys didn't really work well. You see these peaks, but these peaks are an activity of 10 to the minus 6 decays per kilogram. I mean, think about what that means, 10 to the minus 6 decays per kilogram. Okay, anyhow, we thought it's still too high. So we moved everything now from the crystals. The crystals are naked or bare. And you put it like on a fishing string, and then you put it in a huge tank full of argon. Argon can be very clean. And this crystal, and you just sneak these kind of detectors in here with minimal amount of support and cables you need, because these are the crystals. So they all go in here. And that's the experiment I'm talking about. So this is inside here. There's 80 tons of argon. This will be filled by water. Of course, this guy is allowed to go out before. and then we have, of course, muons going through. You've got Cherenkov light, and you can veto events. And in this way, is Goethe the only experiment? So we had two phases. So this was phase one. And you see, we had events all over the place. But then we made another period and high nerve pressure cleaning campaign. And you see for the phase two, at the moment, we have no event. And the beauty here is that this is a peak energy resolution. If this would be more fat, this one or this one would sneak in and we would not be background free anymore. The beauty in this case is the half-life you want to know scales still with the measuring time. If you have this scenario, it goes with the square root of the measurement time. So this is the only experiment which can do it. And we just claimed recently 8 × 10^25 years, we haven't seen anything. In the meantime, we have more data, so we should be beyond 10^26. So now we go together with a new collaboration. It's called Legend, because one of the older guys called his experiment Genius, and we thought we have to bypass him, so we call it Legend. So this is now 200 kilograms of isotopically enriched material. Don't ask about the price. and if we still don't see anything, and this might be a 1 ton, but then I will be retired at that time, and maybe this experiment will not be anymore in Italy. It will be maybe in snow lab or even deeper, whatever people can find. I skip a few slides because I want to make it a little bit of entertainment. So these germanium detectors are actually very good. For example, you can do a lot of things when you have this very clean background detectors. For example, when you have such a detector, you can also can think about what they have to come in with good red wine. Or what you have, what is a link between germanium semiconductor underground and red wine?
Oh, you can leave it there and it just runs, no?
Yeah, it comes here. It's like the X-Files. It's a real case. It's not a show. It's not a cartoon. But it's real. It's a real case. The red wine files, not the X-Files. Basically, there are bottles of very Chateau Moutot rich Rothschild wine, red wines from France, which you, when you go to this kind of auction stuff, you basically raise a lot of money by doing that because these bottles are really old, right? So the question is, how old is this red wine? And can you determine the age of this red wine, but without opening the bottle? That's, of course, if you open it, you have $10,000 are gone. So there are the bottles from this years of 1900. So these are the suspects, this bottle. So you put these bottles of a germanium detector, which is below. You see here, they have the copper lead shielding, like in the plots I have shown you before. And now people look into what's in these bottles. These are supposed to be from 1900. So the evidence, or the look for, is cesium-137. Cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years and has a peak at 660 keV. And the beauty is that the wine somehow remembers the year he was growing. So there is some information installed. And this is basically the cesium activity in this, which was measured as a function of time in the atmosphere. You see here the atmospheric atomic bombing was starting up to here. Then there was some nuclear fallout, and then there was a treaty in 1962 to ban any atmospheric atomic bomb thing. So the half-life here goes down with 30 years. And here was the Chernobyl accident, reactor accident in 86. And you got a spike again, and then you go back down. So if you can determine the cesium-137 activity and you know, then you know the age. Notice that before 1952, there was no atomic atmospheric bomb testing. So now going back to our bottles here, Bordeaux wine from 1934. So this is a cesium line. So this is a calibration source, a red wine from 1963. You see a clear peak here. This is a spectrum, the red, when you have nothing on top of it, but you look at this spectrum here, this is from the decay chain, the natural ones, but you see this green one here. So this wine can by definition not be produced in 1934, because you see the cesium-137 from the atmospheric bombing tests. This is, you can go on, even older ones, and you see here, this one, for example, you see the cesium line here, you don't see it here, this is fine. And you see this one is a reference, as a calibration reference from 64. Directly after the bombing parts, you see this clear cesium line. And you say, this is a fake, and you pay a bunch of $1,000 more for these bottles. So it's not a non-trivial thing, especially in France, where everything is, of course, linked to quality of wine. That goes on. So this one is Mouton Rothschild, $8,000 per bottle. And actually went to the French government and to the French Office of Justice, because it was really a funny thing. All bottles show cesium, so whatever you do, but even not even on the same level. So they are somehow mixing different things together to try to dilute it or whatever, I don't know. But you see, all these bottles have it. And it was it's a fun story. It's a real fun story. And fun for the, I think the French wine people hate us. but they opened actually one of the bottles because of that. The justice asked for it, and then you made radiocarbon dating, and it was really wine from the 60s, not the wine which is supposed to be for $8,000 from 1900. And so this became to the highest level in France, and there was an American, and there is, an American millionaire. He was retired, and he also called an FBI guy who was retired, and they were really hunting this guy. Because he was going around, he talked to the Pope. You see pictures with him from the Pope and everything, and he was selling all this bottle. And all of a sudden, after this, he vanished. And now they look for him. So this is the latest thing he had in mind, $100,000 bottles. Apparently, these four bottles are supposed to come from Thomas Jefferson times, from 1784 to 1787. So here the cesium didn't work. We tried other dating methods here, but this was inconclusive, so we can't say. But again, these four bottles for this amount of price are still hanging around somewhere. But the guy who was selling them or trying to sell them for this amount of money vanished somewhere. He was a big shot. Everybody knew him, at least the rich people. But now he's gone. There's even a book about it, which is not available in every country. But nevertheless, so this is a kind of story what you can do when you have some experience or you have low background detectors. So as I said, the French guys making winery are not probably on our side at the moment. Okay, though, that's maybe just an appetizer for tomorrow. But you see, there are other applications you can do, and then we do the cosmology and what the status is on double beta decay. You have pretty much seen. Thank you. Questions.
This was inconclusive because the cesium thing was low, or why? You said it was
to see it at all, because how the cesium cannot go in a closed bottle. So when you see the cesium comes from the wine grapes pick it up while they were growing, and then they were basically this goes into the bottle in the liquid, not in the glass, and then they sell it, make something on it, whatever you make. Get a piece of paper, glue it on it, but of course, if you have your claim something like this, it means that is a really important and old wine, and the cesium is of course in the red wine. But the gamma rays of 660 keV, they sneak out and get detected on a detector.
He was asking why didn't it work for the other bottles.
Sorry.
Why didn't it work for the other bottles?
Why was it inconclusive in that?
Well, this one was a real one. So this one, there was no fake. In 1945, there was.
1780
something. This one there, because if it's there was no trace. There was no trace of cesium measurable. But people that we couldn't measure any. The French people, Phil Hubert was, they couldn't measure anything. And because it's too old anyhow, because it's far away from this, you somehow need this atmospheric bombing testing. Right? You need the cesium from the atmospheric bombing to make it. So for 1700, there was nothing, and we have to go.
You say it's not from the 60s.
Sorry?
It's from earlier than 1950, right?
Yeah, but the people tried another dating method, which is old enough, but it was inconclusive, though. The signal was so small that he was looking for, I don't know which isotope it was, but he was also trying to get them because they got him from this American a millionaire, I think he had the bottles or one of them. And any radioactive dating was or whatever, any finding any isotopes which shows that this is no. Yeah, hold on. This was in a newspaper once. They found the guy who did the engraving. The engraving is wrong. They was doing a glass dating, and then somehow they were hunting on the glass dating how the description, how you write these letters or engrave it into the glass. This didn't fit to something, and they found somebody close to Heidelberg. They found somebody who made the engraving. So after hunting him, that's why I said the American millionaire hired an FBI retired agent, and they were hunting this guy down. And after the wine bottle, they heard about this Thomas and Jefferson one. And then after some years, they found him. I remember the newspaper. I can show you the article. Then they looked for the engraving. They thought the writing type of this 300 years ago was different than they would expect it. And then they found the guy who did the engraving. Yeah. This was a different way, not a radioactive way, but see, be careful. I think McDonald's has no problem. No, it doesn't. I always wonder in our canteen in the university whether I put a fish on my detector, then I probably would see. Oh yeah, you should do mushrooms, also good. If you want to see radioactive isotopes, at least in Europe with Chernobyl, you can still do the mushrooms. Or we have seen Fukushima in Europe, so the stuff from Japan flew to California, and the Californians saw it, and it continued over the Atlantic. And if you have a really good detector, you can even see the Fukushima outcome in Europe. But you have a bit of action, but you can find all the isotopes you produce when the nuclear fission reactor collapses or is melting. You got all these isotopes you can find. The activity is very small, but if you look carefully enough, then you can see it. Okay, so there are a lot of other things you can do with germanium detectors. You see. That's why I picked it for this talk, because with xenon detectors or calcium fluoride scintillators, all this stuff doesn't work as well. So make some funny stories. Any more? Okay, then tomorrow we finalize some boundaries from this matrix element, and then we talk until Raphael will do it later. We talk about cosmology because Planck has released the latest data today from 2018. So we have an even stronger bound on neutrino masses, which I show you tomorrow. Unless Raphael comes up with it tonight.